Hello.
Thank you. Hello, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to this one-on-one dialogue with Jan Dielemann, who is the President of Cargill Ocean Transport. But Jan, you also have another hat, and that is as the Chair of the Global Maritime Forum. So I guess throughout this dialogue, you can choose which hat you would like to wear for the different questions. So this morning and until to now, we covered quite a bit of ground, naturally on geopolitics, but also on decarbonization, on AI, and finance. So there's a few topics that also I would like to get your views on, Jan, as we progress. And I think one of the things that really came out, especially on the geopolitical side, is that we are not only talking about bumps in the road, but actually things that might even change trade patterns, the way business are being carried out. And what I would really like to ask you is, how do you see that the global geopolitical turmoil is affecting the way that you plan your operations and investments? And I guess with this question, you have the Cargill hat on.
Yeah, I'll take the cargo hat on that one. First of all, I would like to start by saying that tariffs are nothing new, right? We've seen tariffs for many, many years. We've seen geopolitical situations for many, many years. I think what the real difference is somehow the speed of them coming at you and the sheer amount of them, because we have a lot at the same time. I do think what you're saying is some of that is also probably a little bit more structural. What was said earlier in the panel as well is that normally these things are good for shipping because they create inefficiencies. Inefficiencies normally leads to higher rates. But that is only to the extent that you actually have a growth in GDP and growth in global trade. And I think what is different this time around is that the backdrop that we have all this turmoil is around a future vision where it's not that obvious that we're going to continue to grow global trade as what we've done in the last couple of decades.
Which is naturally concerning not only to global shipping, but to all economies around the world. And is it true that we are already seeing that trade is becoming more fragmented, different blocks emerging, and new corridors are forming? And what new patterns are you seeing in your day-to-day business? Or moving cargo from A to B, and are you switching your operations to suit that change?
Well, what you see mainly in the bulk space, where the tramping, I find it always amazing to see how quickly markets actually adjust. When there's a tariff on exports out of the U.S., all of a sudden you see a lot of the beans exports moving to Brazil overnight. When we saw the USTR first consultation, the first thing that happened is that people started pricing in the new kind of potential rates, and that basically stopped U.S. exports overnight. So you can see that the market is really, really reacting to this very, very quickly. What you are seeing, indeed, what you're saying is that there is certain parts of the trade, the global trade, that you might not even have access to. And a good example for us, for instance, is the Black Sea. Outside the Ukraine, it's very, very difficult to be involved in that trade. So that's an area where you're basically getting excluded. And that is also a bit problematic, not just because you want to be involved in these trades, but also because you have a lot less visibility of what's actually happening in those markets, which then you can use to position yourself better in other ways. I think what it does is it's a little bit linked to decarbonization, which is creating a world in shipping that's a lot more complex than what we've seen before. And that will probably also drive somehow consolidation, because I think smaller players in an area like this, if you only have two ships and they're in the wrong area, that's a problem. If you have 600 ships and you have a few in the wrong area, that's okay, and you can deal with that. So having a big portfolio, I think, is important, and I think scale is going to matter even more going forward.
And having a big portfolio naturally gives you that flexibility. But I mean, if I look to the statistics on the aging fleet, I mean, we have now more than, I believe, more than 50% of the fleet is more than 20 years old. And naturally, with the backdrop of so much uncertainty on the economic side, on the finances, investments, etc., how would you say be able to make decisions on the necessary upgrades and investments on the sailing fleet?
I think it's extremely complicated at the moment to make any bold decisions, especially on new builds, and that's for a variety of reasons. First of all, if you look at asset prices, they're still very, very high compared to what you can make in time charter returns. So that is one thing. The other thing is there's still some uncertainty around what USTR really means. What is an owner, Chinese owner, what is it not? And then, of course, in October, we have another big thing coming. That is the MAPC, I think it's called B or 2, where we're going to have the rectification of this, because that has also got significant impact on what kind of decisions you make. Especially, I would say, if you go to, say, Japan, or you go to the state-owned companies in China, before you get a delivery, it's probably 28, sometimes even 29. And then you're getting very, very close to that 2030, where if you look at the proposed regulation, the curve goes up quite significantly. So it's sometimes difficult, and specifically for someone like me, but sometimes sitting on your hands a little bit and just let it pencil out is probably not a bad thing to do.
And coming a little bit back to the challenge with the aging fleet, I mean, it's not all about the new builds, but also a lot about, you know, how do we make the sailing fleet more adaptable, and how can we also make investment decisions on that fleet when there are quite a lot of uncertainty? And what's your take on that?
I've been advocating for quite some few years on this now. I think it's clearly a non-regret move to upgrade your current fleet. I think there's a lot of things being experimented, and we did quite a few of those, as you know, as well. And that has a payback. So the question is only, do you like the payback? Don't you like the payback? But everything on the horizon here going forward tells you that probably we're going to go towards biofuels, et cetera, which are going to be more expensive. You're going to get regulatory requirements to at least have a minimum trajectory. So if you take it all together, I think still upgrading the fleet that you have today is probably the best investment that you can make today.
And we heard earlier this morning that it is sometimes difficult to transport that cost throughout the value chain, and what's your take on this? And I'm sure that you're also discussing this in the Global Maritime Forum.
Yeah, there's always this notion of sharing cost, etc. And I always find that difficult. What does sharing really mean, and what is fair, what is not fair? If an owner takes an asset for 20 years, should I pay all the investment over the 5-year period? I don't think that's fair. But if you ask my owner's friend, they will say that it's very fair. So I think in the end of the day, what you need to be able to do is just take some of the risk. And the more you get towards these energy-saving devices, it just makes sense. And we as a charter, who in the end of the day is basically paying the fuel cost, have been stepping in quite a few times and said, you know what, if you're not willing or able to make that investment, we will do it, and we will pay the investment back by some of the savings that we are going to get. So I think it's also for people in the supply chain, instead of just pointing to somebody else to take it over, just to step in yourself and say, you know what, I can actually best manage this, and I don't need someone else to take that risk. I can handle that myself.
Thank you for sharing that view. You mentioned the MEPC 83 that took place in April, and it has already been discussed this morning. And you mentioned also the more stringent trajectories. And it was quite an extraordinary decision in the first place. I mean, normally the IMO would work on a consensus basis. In April, we saw that the US basically withdrew from the negotiations. And we also, through the voting, saw that some big and important countries actually voted no, whilst a significant number also abstained from voting. Regardless, it came through on the, say, simple majority clause. And it leaves a lot of, say, possibilities for speculation towards the adoption in October. And as we know, in October, it's a requirement for 2/3 majority and at least 50% of the tonnage. So what's your take on the landscape, and you know, are we likely to see an adoption, and what could be sort of the curveballs that might undermine progress on the IMO scene?
Yeah, so now, first of all, I would like to underline the importance of regulation in this area, because we basically came to the conclusion that on a voluntary commitment alone, we're just not going to get there. We can't scale. Also, for a lot of people, freight is their scope 3 emissions. There is ways that you can actually reduce your emissions maybe 10 times cheaper than you can actually do in shipping. So without regulation, I think there would have been very, very few things happening. So absolutely key that was agreed. I do think, and I heard this before this morning, I had a bit of a two kind of sided feeling on this. On the one hand, I wanted it to be a lot more ambitious, that we go faster in the transition. But on the other hand, I think there's two things playing. First of all, you can't deny the political environment that we're in. And actually getting people to agree something nowadays, I think, is a massive win. So I think that was a clear win for the industry. Second of all as well is, if we would have gone more ambitious, I think the only thing that we would have done is create a bigger fund, because a lot of the technologies wouldn't have been there anyways in the next couple of years. And we would actually make a potential issue even bigger. That is, how are we going to govern that fund in the IMO, and how are we going to actually spend that? So in the end, I think it's actually very good where we landed, because it minimizes it. It goes step by step. And I think it gives us the tools to tweak it as we go. I do think, if you come back to what do you think in October, I think in any other year I would have said this will go through. I think nowadays you can not just simply state it that way, because it's just too complicated out there. I do think what you said earlier, there was a big group of people that abstained from voting, which mainly the Pacific Island states. I would think that in the end of the day, they would vote in favor of this and not against this. So I'm quite optimistic that this will get over the line. But what was also said this morning, I think there's a lot of stuff to be worked out. Life cycle analysis, et cetera, and how are we going to treat this fund? How are we going to distribute the funds? How is that mechanism going to work? So there's a lot of work to be done, and the devil will be in the detail in the end.
Yeah, it's going to be truly interesting to see how it pans out in October, and also what sort of influence the U.S. might have on the entire process, not sort of being part of it at all. I want to turn now to a slightly different topic, a topic that I know that you have engaged passionately in, and that is the dark fleet, or the parallel fleet. And naturally, it holds a lot of safety concerns that we are all very much preoccupied and concerned with. But sort of, if we try and look at this from a more geopolitical point of view, and we see that hopefully there will be some progress in peace talks, there will be a lesser conflict in the world some years ahead. What's your take on sort of parts of the dark fleet or parallel fleet coming back into the, say, the normal fold of shipping?
Yeah, so first of all, I think that the whole dark fleet, what has always been striking to me is that people talk about it as a separate fleet, but it shares the same oceans, the same ports, the same everything. So I think it was a little bit too easy just to say that's a dark fleet. We don't need to look at safety. We don't need to govern that one. How you do that is a completely different story, and I'm not going to go in there because I don't have a clear answer on that. If you look at the looking forward on the dark fleet, I think theoretically that issue should become smaller, as we're hopefully going to get less sanctions because we're going to get some of these issues resolved. So that's absolutely the case. Some of these ships will come back into the industry, and in the end of the day, it is the market rates that will determine if these ships are going to get scrapped or not. So we will have to see significantly lower rates on some of these asset classes before you're actually really going to get rid of those ships, which I think we all know that has to happen, but the price have not made that move just yet.
And when we talk about the dark or the parallel fleet, it's not one sort of uniform group of vessels. I mean, you have really high quality vessels and you have really low quality vessels in that fleet. So let's hope that at least the substandard part of that fleet is taken out by scrapping, and then we get sort of the quality fleet back into, say, normal governance and normal trade. I would like to finally ask you about your supply chains diversifying and trade routes shifting fast, as we briefly mentioned in the beginning. As an industry, have we got the resilience needed to meet these changes and challenges?
I think this is an industry that is shown over and over again that it can adapt and reinvent itself. So let's don't forget about that. And I think it will do it again with all the known unknown somehow. And I think and this was one of the earlier panels, I think it's going to be a bit more complicated, is the whole adoption of AI, adoption of digital, where I think a big part of the industry is not ready. And that is something I think I would encourage everyone to really not forget about, because we talk a lot about decarbonization, we talk a lot about geopolitics, but probably the biggest change here going forward is digitalization and specifically Gen AI.
And, you know, we heard on a panel this morning that that train of AI is really moving fast. Personally, I'm always sort of struggling a bit to differentiate between what is hype and what is real practical applications of AI. Any views on your side?
No, I think it's right. And when I just go back about 5-6 years ago, we did a strategy review, and there was three things coming out. And guess what? One was geopolitical changes. The other one was that decarbonization was going to come to shipping one way or form, and we're going to go digitalize the whole industry. And the first two absolutely have happened. The third one up to now has been kind of unimpressing, right? We were talking about Uber for shipping 5-6 years ago. Well, that didn't get very, very far. I think where we're sitting now is a very different approach. It's not a big one thing that's going to change at all, but it's really going to be a step-by-step adoption of AI for the use cases that actually make sense. And I start seeing it in our business, I see it in some of the businesses that I'm in boards of, that you start really seeing progress, and the hype thing becomes actually real. And that's because I think a lot of people are looking at kind of bite-sized kind of initiatives, and I think that makes an awful lot of sense. It's not just this big Amazon or whatever it is going to change the industry. It's all of us with little steps that are going to make this movement happen.
So more like an evolution than a revolution in your view. I know that both of us and our organizations are very much preoccupied with the seafarers and the well-being of seafarers. And in the environment that we're in now, anything more that we should do and need to do to really make sure that our seafarers are safe and taken well care of?
Yeah, the seafarer part is close to my heart. It's something that we don't control directly. As a charterer, you normally don't have the direct influence, but you can still advocate. And I think that is a big role that we play. I just read that the abandonment number was up 30% year on year. I think as an industry, we should be really ashamed of that, to be honest. We are running out of seafarers. We also know that. We also know that we have to upgrade the existing seafarers to all the new technologies that we have coming. So I think it's not just only the right thing to do to make sure that people have at least decent working conditions, but I think it's also absolutely a business case to get on, because we need those people and we need them even more going forward.
Thank you so much, Jan, for sharing your views on quite a big span of different topics. But I really enjoyed the conversation, and I think you ought to give Jan a very big hand for his insights. Thank you very much.